Kick off summer with Memorial Day savings at Lowe's. Right now, get five Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. Plus, get up to 40% off select major appliances and save an extra $50 on every $500 you spend on select major appliances $396 or more. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 5/28. Mulch offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison. And we're very excited to welcome to the podcast today someone who I've followed on Twitter for years but have never met, Emily Herring. Emily's a writer based in Paris. She also received her PhD in the history and philosophy of science from the University of Leeds. And we've invited her to talk about her new book, Herald of a Restless World, how Henri Bergson brought philosophy to the people, which just came out with Basic in October. Emily, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I think the history and philosophy of silence should be my next book, actually. That sounds great.
I think that's where we're all headed, unfortunately. So I'm sure like many young people growing up in the 90s, we all had Bergson on the mind. So it was just inevitable that someone was going to write about him. So how did you come to write about Henri Bergson, the guy no one could stop talking about?
So I grew up in France. I'm half French, half British. And in France, everyone studies philosophy in high school. So that's when I was first introduced to Bergson's ideas, because in France, he's still somewhat well-known, I guess, in philosophical circles, at least. And then I studied philosophy. So I grew more and more interested in him and really enjoyed reading him. And so I ended up doing a PhD thesis on him, and you know, it was just a total obsession at that point, which is required to do a PhD, I think. And then I've since quit academia, I thought that his story needed to be told because it's such a fascinating story, and one that has been forgotten, in particular in the English-speaking world, where he was once extremely famous.
So why don't we get into him? Where does he come from? He's born, if I remember correctly, in 1859 in France. What's going on there? And how does his intellectual development proceed as a child? And then that we might take him till he first attends university.
Right. So yes, as you said, he's born in 1859 in Paris. His father is a Polish immigrant, Jewish, and he was a musician. He was a composer.
Po buddies nerfect.
He was a struggling composer. And so the family had sort of financial difficulties, but young Henri was extremely talented and doing really well at school. So he managed to get all these scholarships to study in extremely prestigious Parisian schools. And his family eventually moved to London, because that's where his mother was British. But he stayed in Paris. So at age 10, he was kind of separated from his family and lived in a kind of boarding institution to be able to attend these highly prestigious Parisian schools, where he won all sorts of prizes in Latin and mathematics. And he actually was a bit of a maths genius. When he was still in high school, he solved a problem that the 17th century French polymath Blaise Pascal had left without a solution, and 17-year-old Henri solved it, but to his math teacher despair, he decided that he wanted to study philosophy, because he felt that philosophy was, and I tend to agree, it's a subject that allows you to avoid specialization, or at least to delay specialization, because you can kind of take anything as your subject matter.
So what's going on in French philosophy in the late 19th century? It might be worthwhile situating the major debates and how Bergson becomes someone who really reshapes how philosophy is thought of over the course of the, I'll never pronounce this, fin de siècle? How do you pronounce it?
Fin de siècle.
Fin de siècle. How did he, fin de siècle. So how did that come to be? What is the intellectual world that he's moving through in his first studies? Where does he attend university? Are there any particular people he's reacting and responding to?
Sure. So he attended the École Normale Supérieure, which is a bit of a weird French institution where it's very competitive to get in, and it's sort of a relic, but that still exists, of the Napoleon era, where the idea is to train the people who will then train the intellectual elite of the country. So high profile academics. And there, in at that time, so in the sort of 1870s, 1880s in France, there's kind of one side of things is to do with positivism, which is this idea, to put it fairly crudely, the idea that it's the question how that is interesting rather than the question why. So we're not going to focus on these big metaphysical questions, and that's actually to ask the question why is the sign of a childish theological or metaphysical mind. And actually what we want to do is just stick to positive empirical fact. So that was a very crude definition of what positivism was. But there's Auguste Comte and Herbert Spencer and people like that are very influential. And then on the other side, there's a school of thought called spiritualism, which has nothing to do with sort of moving tables and ghosts, but more to do with introspection and taking consciousness very seriously. And in a way, I would say, even though Bergson built himself kind of against almost both of those schools, he actually also incorporates them both and performs a kind of synthesis of them both, because he both takes consciousness and spirit and qualitative experience very seriously, but he also takes science and empirical fact very seriously. And so another way of looking at what he ended up doing, you can stop me if I keep going for too long, because
I'm just curious. So just as an intellectual historian, I'm curious, like, what are his first interventions? How does he build on people like Comte? How does he build on the more spiritualist side? What is he thinking through? Because this is also a moment when the disciplines themselves are in flux. Famously, Comte becomes a quote unquote founder along with Marx of sociology, which isn't like quite a thing yet. So how is he moving through this like a disciplinary ferment? What are his early interventions? How does he begin to come to people's attentions? And feel free to go deep into the ideas, because we don't do a ton of intellectual history, but I think it's actually really important for people to understand.
Great. So one of Bergson's very early influences was Herbert Spencer, who I've already mentioned. So a British philosopher who was very famous in France, actually, in the second half of the 19th century. He's also kind of a forgotten figure now, but he was he's in particular known for I think coming up with survival of the fittest. I always get it mixed up, but he influenced Darwin quite a bit, and he's known for social Darwinism, which is kind of an infamous take.
I like that. Social Darwinism, a very hot take. A hot take on social life.
But that was not what Bergson was interested. He wasn't interested in the social Darwinism aspect of it. It was more the very ambitious project that Spencer had, that a lot of, I guess, 19th century guys had in one way or another. But he was hoping to unify all of the sciences and philosophy under one big theory that he called synthetic philosophy.
Right. And this was the great age, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is the great age of the search for systems, right? Mm-hmm. This is like the great philosophers, like this is what Comte was doing with society, right? Trying
Absolutely.
To develop an entire theory of interlinking parts, which is, of course, very influenced by Marxian thinking about the social totality. And so these things haven't become like split off yet, necessarily. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. And young Bergson was very seduced by this idea that it would be possible, by looking at you know, what the empirical sciences are doing and what the laws of matter, but also the laws of society, to combine them under one big theory. And he was hoping to pursue that and to even go even further than Spencer. And he viewed himself at that time as a positivist, as a mechanist. So very different from what he would later become. But it was in this kind of, so while all the time he was at the ENS, the École Normale Supérieure, He was sort of obsessed with Spencer and that kind of project. And that's the project he intended to pursue when he started his PhD research. And then the way he tells it, so at this point he'd moved to a provincial town, Clermont-Ferrand.
And this is the 1880s, right?
It's the 1880s, exactly. Yeah. So the early 1880s. And he starts working on his PhD project. And the way he tells it is that in order to pursue this big Spencerian project, he starts looking at the concepts of mechanics, of physics. And it's when he starts looking at time that he suddenly has this kind of crisis of he sort of starts to move away from all these deeply held mechanistic positivistic beliefs, and he moves on to something completely different, a big change of heart. And the way he describes it is that he had a surprise when, looking at the letter T in the equations of mechanics, he realized that this letter T that represents time contained no temporality at all. And so that's the beginning of one of his central ideas of duration, which isn't a very good translation.
Right. I was going to ask, durée, this is like his big early idea, right? This is what this is what really brings him onto the scene. And you spend quite a bit of time on it. And so could we actually talk about this concept? You already talked a little bit about where it came from. We could talk a little bit about more about that more. But how does this fit into, first of all, what does it say and how does it fit into the late 19th century French philosophy? And then we could talk about how it travels.
Mm-hmm. So as I was hinting at a little bit, so this central idea of his philosophy is this realization that time, as represented in scientific equations, as well as in everyday language, contains no temporality. So when we talk about time, what we're actually doing is borrowing from a category external to time, which is space. There's a quite helpful thought experiment that he uses in his first book, which was his PhD thesis, where he asks the reader to imagine a powerful entity, a genie, who is able to accelerate time. And so the Earth rotates on its axis in 12 hours instead of 24, and all other phenomena accelerate proportionally. And the point he's making is that to the equations of astrophysics, this would make no difference. All the proportions would be well preserved. But to the person experiencing this change in tempo, a huge difference would be felt, a change in the qualitative experience of the progress accomplished between sunrise and sunset. And that's precisely what is removed from the T in the equation of physics. That's precisely what scientists have to get rid of if they want to be able to measure. And so this is a big departure from precisely the positivist stance. This is dangerous metaphysics to the positivists. This idea of qualitative, the importance of the conscious experience.
How does Durée play into what's going on, and how does it become, you know, this big concept for him?
Sure. I think, you know, even broader than the 19th century French philosophy, this idea that, so this idea of durée, this idea that I've not gone into much detail in yet, because actually what I've just done is told you sort of what it isn't. But this idea that concepts, everyday language, philosophy, and science fail to capture this sort of flow of existence and this the way in which time accumulates and it cannot be subjected to measurement, and or in order to be subjected to measurement, it has to be transformed into something spatial other than it is. And the emphasis that Bergson places on change and the importance of change, the sort of constant change at work all the time in the universe, I think that is something that kind of flips on its head millennia of Western philosophy, that was up until then kind of focused on the eternal and the unmoving and the sort of perfection of eternity, you know, from Plato to Descartes to even to the positivists. There's this idea that there is more, it is better to think about things in terms of pure, immovable, concept.
Yeah, a unity almost, that there's a unity that you're searching for in concepts, literally, right? Which is very, this is why, to correct me if I'm wrong, he's also often talked about as proto-postmodern. Right, because he sort of like emphasizes disunity and movement and things like that, and so this is going against that.
Yeah. So what he's saying is, because if you take someone, I mean, again, this is going to be extremely crude, but if you take a sort of Platonic way of seeing things, the most real thing is going to be the eternal idea of the thing, and then all the instances of the thing are just going to be these decaying, corruptible versions.
Yeah, bastardizations almost, right? Lesser and this is the whole cave metaphor, right? You could only see the bastardization. Yeah.
And whereas what Bertin is saying, he's flipping that on its head and saying, actually, the eternal conceptual version of the thing is just a symbol of it. And the actual real, the real reality is this ever-changing. There is no sort of substrate upon which things are changing. There is only change. And in order to be able to make sense of that change, in order to be able to measure things in the physical world, we have to treat it as if it's static and not moving. But at the heart of things is change. So I think that's quite radical for his time. And it certainly inspired a lot of people after him, including Whitehead, who's known in the English-speaking world as sort of the process philosopher. But sort of Bertin has been saying these things.
Just a quick question. Is that linked to the secularization that happens over the course of the 19th century and the fact that he was part Jewish? Because it seems like it's going down from God to a really centering the human, and instead of an eternal unity, you're focusing on a lived dynamism. That's what stuck out to me. And, you know, this is obviously a period of Jewish assimilation. There's Dreyfus a couple of decade-ish later. And so how do you see this large idea relating to not only what's happening within philosophy, but what's happening in the context within which Bertin operates?
Yeah, that's interesting. I'd actually not thought about it in those terms, because his relationship to religion is very complicated, and he's not really that vocal or interested in either his own, you know, himself being Jewish or his own sort of faith until a lot later, when actually he then turns more towards Catholicism a lot later in life. I'm not actually sure that is a way of looking at it, because in Creative Evolution, he does end up talking about a form of divinity. And actually he thinks of God as evolving as well. He thinks the movement itself of evolution as divine itself, sort of the creation as a process, even in the divine sense. So I think he manages to somehow, even subvert that, I guess, in a sense.
Well, I'm just influenced. I don't know if you ever read Malachi Hakon on Karl Popper. But he was my PhD advisor, and so his whole thing is like all these guys like who never talked about Jew being Jewish is like that's kind of it. That's a silence. Speaking of, you know, that's a philosophy of silence, a history of silence. And so he's always trying to relate it, and I think there's some insight. No, there's a lot of insight into it. I don't want to apply it to Bergson if it doesn't, but there's a lot of insight when you're talking about Central European people and East Central European people about like how their position within society wound up shaping their philosophy. And this to me seems like very like secularizing out of the shtetl type, you know, post-Jewish Enlightenment idea. But why don't we talk about how does his career proceed over the course of the 1880s and 1890s? How does he become this international figure that you discuss? And how does Duret travel, to make a stupid pun?
So he publishes his PhD thesis, which is where he first presents this idea of Duret, and it's sort of well received in a very small French academic philosophical circles. And then his goal is to climb the ranks of French academia, and to do that you kind of have to make your way back to Paris. So usually you're sent off to the provinces to do a few years teaching there, and then you have to claw your way back. So that's what he attempts to do. So he refuses some jobs that are outside of Paris, and then he gets a job in a sort of prestigious lycée, so teaching secondary school students, but it's getting him closer and closer to where he wants to be. His second book, Matter and Memory, comes out in the 1890s. It's slightly more noticed by in French academic circles. So that kind of establishes him as someone, you know, to look out for, to be reckoned with. And that puts him in a good position career-wise. He's rejected by the Sorbonne because the Sorbonne is kind of a positivist mechanist mecca at the time. That might be one of the reasons. But he manages to get into another institution, equally as prestigious, really, called the Collège de France, which is another strange French institution. I'm not sure there's an equivalent, but it's existed for centuries. It still does. And the idea is that it's sort of top academics hired there, but all the lectures are public lectures. So there's no enrollment, there's no exams. It's just anyone can go and listen to the lectures. And he manages in 1900 to get a chair at the Collège de France. And that, it's around that time. So in 1900, he publishes Laughter, which your listeners might, that might be the book they've heard of, if they've heard of him at all. Sorry. And it's around sort of 1903, 1904, 1905 that more and more people seem to appear in his lecture theatre. In 1907, he publishes Creative Evolution, which is a philosophical take on biological evolution. And that's when things really kick off, first in France, and then it's translated quite quickly, yeah, into English. And he kind of explodes then.
So let's talk. I want to get to the explosion in a second, but what do we, listeners need to know about the intellectual development over that 20-ish year period? How is Duret applied? What are the big takeaways? What always fascinates me the most personally about this period is like the fact that the physicists were actually reading the philosophers who were actually mm-hmm. reading the physicists. And it's just like, I love this pre-specialization moment, or sort of this mm-hmm. like forming specialization moment. It seems like really fun time to be an intellectual where you could like yeah. legitimately like influence Einstein. You know, like that's something yeah. that like a philosopher could do, which I don't think many philosophers are influencing many physicists today. But so how does his thought develop? And, mm-hmm. and maybe you could talk a little bit about this sort of boundary crossing of sure. permeable boundaries at this moment.
Yeah. So that, yeah, you're right to push me in that direction, because that's definitely a really interesting part of the story, which is that in every single one of his books, Bergson is reading more empirical literature than he is philosophy, actually. So in Matter and Memory, it's sort of all the literature on amnesia and aphasia, and so all the pathologies of memory that he's reading about, and he's reading up all this neurophysiology, and he's kind of both sort of speaking to millennia old debates about perception and the real world, but also talking to the neuroscientists, saying that just because cerebral lesions seem to affect memory doesn't mean that memory is stored in the brain in the way that they think. So he's having these massive conversations. And as you said, scientists, experimental psychologists, the lines are quite blurry still. And it's a time when specialization is taking hold. It's a time when the word scientist is actually being used in the sense that we know today. And creative evolution is a really interesting example of the way that there were these conversations happening across disciplinary borders. So we mentioned earlier that Bergson was born in 1859, which is quite an important year because that's the year Darwin...
On the Origin of Species! Yes.
That is. So he was born the same year as The Origin. And obviously evolutionary debates were a huge deal for decades. There were debates about whether Darwin was correct about evolution, but then there were debates about the way evolution worked. And for a long time, natural selection wasn't accepted, even among those who accepted evolution, natural selection wasn't accepted as the mechanism of evolution. So there were all at least four or five competing theories. And in France, actually, a lot of the biologists were hung up on a Lamarckian form of evolution. And so Bergson kind of enters the chat in 1907, proposing his highly metaphysical, philosophical view. So he's not attempting to replace any of these theories, but he's attempting to show that, and it's similar to what I was saying before, that the ways in which our concepts are designed is to make things solid and rigid and unmovable. And that's fine if you're doing physics to a certain extent, but it doesn't work at all, or it works poorly, or you're going to miss something if you apply it to things, phenomena like biological evolution, living organisms. The concepts are too rigid, for instance, to hold things as obvious as, you know, reproduction versus being an individual. Organisms seem to tend to both, and our concepts aren't really able to hold all of that. And what I find fascinating about that time, there were so many incredible debates happening in biology, but there were, as you said, many, many, many scientists and many biologists who engaged really seriously with Bergson and who actually used this philosophical text as a way to resist specialization. Being a Bergsonian biologist wasn't just about what Bergson was saying, but it was also about saying, look, we're biologists, which means that we have to deal with consciousness. We have to deal with physics as well, because, you know, organisms are made of matter, but they're also, you know, to a certain extent conscious. So we have to be psychologists and physicists. We can't be put into a box. We need to do everything. And that's why there were a lot of them were so enthusiastic about Bergson, because he was taking biology really seriously from a philosophical point of view. And he was elevating biology in a sense by doing so.
Kick off summer with Memorial Day savings at Lowe's. Right now, get 5 Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. Plus, get up to 40% off select major appliances and save an extra $50 on every $500 you spend on select major appliances $396 or more. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 5/28. Mulch offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details.
It's always struck me that a lot of the French philosophers, Foucault, Fanon, really engage with the medical sciences and the hard sciences in a very explicit way that's core to their thought, which is true in other national contexts, but doesn't seem to have the influence in other national contexts that it does in France. Maybe let's talk about this international explosion. So why does this happen? It's 1907, I believe. Why does this happen? And how does this shape Bergson?
Yeah, so it's kind of crazy, really, when you look at how quickly it all happened, and it was a bit of a shock to him even. But around 1907, Creative Evolution becomes a bestseller in France within a few weeks. So then it sort of, you know, it's garnering a lot of attention abroad as well, and it's quite quickly translated. And it's to the point that around 1910, around 1910, Bergson's lectures at the Collège de France have become so popular that the room that can seat about 300 people isn't big enough, because every week about 700 people, 1,000 people are trying to get in. People are traveling from across the world to come and hear his lectures. And that exports to the UK, to the US, where Bergson travels and famously, or I don't know if famously, famously for me, who's obsessed with these things, he caused the first ever traffic jam on Broadway when he lectured at Columbia University in, I think, 1912. The dates are fuzzy now. It's been a while since I wrote the book, but I think it was 1912 or 13. As to why this happens, that's the question I was asking myself in the book, because it is sort of hysteria. You know, there are stories of people trying to steal locks of his hair from his barber, which I don't know if
that's never happened to you as when you teach.
I don't know if that can possibly be true, because if you look at photos of him, there isn't much hair to be stolen in the first place. But
that just makes it more valuable. That's just the free market.
This is why I started giving myself buzz cuts at home, because it was too much. Like the people just like coming in and like grabbing pieces of hair was just freaking
devastating.
Yeah,
but yeah, it goes to a level that was, you know, unheard of, especially for this very quiet, mild-mannered man. There seems to be an element of he was very good at lecturing. I don't think that's enough to explain it, but people who describe the experience of attending his lectures describe it in almost religious terms of sort of a total enchantment, the melodic quality of his voice, The way he seems to be able to weave together without using notes these complicated ideas. So that's definitely a one explanation. But there also another explanation might be that Bergson believed that philosophy should be written and said in everyday language, which doesn't mean he was dumbing anything down. It just meant that he wasn't Hegel, let's say, or Kant. He seemed accessible, even though that was perhaps not entirely, you know, people weren't necessarily understanding everything. But so that's another possible explanation. And then there also seems to be a sense in which he, no pun intended or pun intended, he was timely in that he arrived at a time when there was increasing unease with what people viewed as the progress of science and technology, scientific theories and quantification sort of seeping into areas where it hadn't been before. Human consciousness, the theory of evolution was making a lot of people uneasy, and not just for religious reasons, but also for the sort of existential consequences of what, you know, what evolution was saying about, and what Darwinian natural selection seemed to be saying about nature being this cold, mechanistic, you know, violent place that people, so this sense of general disenchantment about the mechanization of the world. And then you have this very eloquent French philosopher who's explaining that science is actually, you know, science is doing its thing and it's right to be doing its thing, but it's missing something crucial about what individual conscious experience is, about what evolution means. So there's a sense he was probably bringing hope to the disenchanted.
Yeah, to Weberian and Zauberung, right? There's a disenchantment, and then Bergson is providing some alternative to, like, oh, actually there is some spiritual something, if spiritual isn't quite the right word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And another factor that perhaps explains this the incredible level of notoriety is that because of the way he wrote and the way he spoke, and because of the, I guess, unsystematic way he presented his philosophy, and because of the way he avoided using rigid concepts and often resorted to more, imagistic language, which doesn't mean not rigorous, but some people who perhaps didn't read him very carefully were able to take from him whatever they wanted. And so there were so many versions of what Bergsonism was in the early 20th century. There were, you know, there were feminist Bergsonisms, there were revolutionary syndicalist Bergsonisms, there was Cubist Bergsonism, there was modernist Catholic Bergsonism, and then later there were more right-wing versions as well. So it seems that people were able to pick and choose and invest their own meaning into these catchphrases they were getting out of his philosophy, which helped his name spread, but didn't necessarily help his ideas actually spread that well.
So just a couple of questions are broad. The first one is, how is he relating to the political context of early 20th century France?
Mm. So you mentioned the Dreyfus Affair earlier, which really, you know, divided the country in ways that in a really strong way. His attitude towards the Dreyfus Affair is quite characteristic of his attitude towards politics to a certain extent, which was complete silence. As a Jewish man, faced with a topic that seemingly it was impossible to not have a take, he refused to say anything about it. And some people close to him took this as slightly cowardly. Others sort of speculated that he was perhaps afraid of more retaliation that he was already getting, because as a very famous Jewish man in France in the early 20th century, he was already being subjected to huge amounts of anti-Semitism, really violent rhetoric. And so there was a sense in which he was probably trying to not draw more attention to himself. And he had these ways of sort of dismissing political issues by saying that his opinion was of no value, not of any more value than anyone else, because he hadn't had time to think about it. That's how he would fend off journalists. He would say, well, I would need to think about it for a year or two, so you can come back to me, you know, in a year or two, and I can tell you what I think about women getting the vote or whatever. So he was very cautious until World War One, which we might get to. But he had this way of being, absent from political discourse, whilst I think having, from what I was able to gather, having this what we might call centrism really at his heart, where he really believed in the institutions, and he didn't really like violent methods of protest. He was sort of sympathetic to the suffragettes, but didn't like their violent methods. He was, you know, that was the kind of thing he would say in private.
He was no Sorellian, to say the least.
No.
So one more question. How in this pre-World War I period is his thought taken up in other countries? I know you said there were a diversity of sort of interpretations, but how does he shape U.S. philosophy? How does he shape British philosophy? And if you can, the one I'm most familiar with around this period is actually German thought. Any thoughts you have about those three national contexts, U.S., U.K., sure. and Germany?
So it's really interesting, because in the US, in the UK, for instance, he gets quite a cold reception in UK philosophy. That is kind of, it's the beginnings of what we call analytic philosophy, I guess, or perhaps not the beginnings, but it's the beginnings of Bertrand Russell's career, let's say, who is very hostile to Bergson, and who kind of spearheads an anti-Bergson campaign. So even though Bergson is received in the UK in 1910, 1911 to huge, you know, crowds, and, you know, the general public are really excited to see him, and a lot of UK scientists, but actually the Oxford, Cambridge crowd are not quite as enthusiastic. Russell was both, I think, professionally sort of jealous of Bergson's success, but also just, you know, it was so foreign and so alien to everything that he believed. It was just not possible for them to match. In the US, analytic philosophy hadn't made its way to the US yet. And so the pragmatists were really enthusiastic, interested, sometimes critical. So someone like Dewey is both very open to discussion, and I think they met when Bergson went to the US.
And someone very similar with no system of thought whatsoever, just says shit, yeah.
Absolutely. And then, so Bergson had a huge fan in William James, who I think died around the time Bergson really started to take off. But he was, if you read letters he wrote when he first read Creative Evolution, he's convinced that it's the start of a huge revolution that's going to change the way we do philosophy forever. And he's, you know, writing gushing letters to Bergson as well, calling him a magician. So on the US side, that kind of thing is going on. And I have to admit, I'm not as familiar with the German scene. A friend of mine, Katharina Zanfi, wrote her PhD thesis on Bergson's reception in Germany. I don't know if it's in English yet. It might be translated in English by now. I do know that Bergson believed he wouldn't have a reception in Germany. He was much more focused on his Anglophone reception, and he actually assisted the English translation of Creative Evolution, but he thought the Germans wouldn't get him. I have to say that it's not something I've looked into enough to be able to comment, but I would recommend Zanfi.
Well, I'm especially interested in the German language, given that, you know, the Austrians become such, that basically the most important positivists of the 20th century. So, I imagine they rejected him, but TBD. Derek, I know you had a question.
Yeah, I mean, Emily, you alluded to it earlier, but why don't we talk about Bergson during World War One? It seems he makes a political turn here. He spends some time in America, I think. How does he react to the onset of war, and what is kind of role does he see for himself?
Yeah, sure. And just before I get to that, obviously, yes, the Vienna Circle hated Bergson. I mean, yeah, the Austrian...
Otto Neurath wasn't a fan.
Weirdly, no. So World War One arrives at sort of the apex of Bergson's fame, worldwide fame. And in France, it's the time when he gets appointed to the Académie Française, which is sort of one of the highest positions you can hold. You're elected for life and you are one of the guardians of the French language, and you have a sword, and you they gather and they write the dictionary together, and they, you know, it's all very weird. So he's also I think president that year in 1914 of the Academy of Moral and Political Sciences, which is another prestigious institution, and acting as president of that society. When the war breaks out, he gives a speech, a series of speeches actually, where he is uncharacteristically sort of political and quite nationalistic, or at least very patriotic, depending on how you want to look at it, where he compares Germany to sort of dead, mechanistic, you know, brutes, and France and its allies to an élan vital of, you know, a creative force that must prevail. And he, you know, he goes quite far in his rhetoric, and he calls the Germans sort of barbarians and things like that. So this is quite a departure from the line he'd held up until then to not be political. He kind of moved away from that later. Around the 1930s, actually, he sort of moved away from that rhetoric, but it stuck, and it kind of contributed to a lot of the sort of more left-leaning people who had been supporters of his moved away from him after World War One. But what happens during World War One is really interesting, and I think will be interesting to an American audience, in that in 1917, the French government is kind of wondering how to get the US to join the war on their side. And they're thinking about sending a diplomat to talk to President Wilson, but they think that will be perceived as too aggressive. And they end up asking Bergson to go to Washington. And because they think that Wilson will potentially be swayed by this renowned philosopher, because Wilson is something of an academic himself. And so that's what happens. Bergson, you know, crosses the Atlantic at a time when it's very dangerous to do so because of sort of submarine warfare. And Bergson goes there, spends several months there. He plays a clever game of networking where he manages to befriend close counselors of Wilson, and sort of get into their ear. And then he eventually meets Wilson himself. There's no record of the whatever was said, but we know from Bergson's notes that the main arguments he would have put forth were to do with the US having a seat at the Society of Nations table. For that to happen, they would have to take part in the war, and that's something that potentially Wilson would have been swayed by. And it's a little episode of the war story that's not told very often, which I find absolutely fascinating. So it's kind of, yeah, the secret mission.
And so how does his career proceed after the war? Is he someone who made his major contributions by that point and he's just resting on his laurels, or does his thought develop in a meaningful way? Because eventually this is somewhat, you're doing a project of recovery. So something changes over the later 20th century where Bergson, at least in the Anglo world, is not really read as much. So maybe we could start with what happens after the war, what happens in the last decades of his life, both intellectually and personally. And then I'd like to hear about why you think he was forgotten.
Mm-hmm. So after the war, he has become this kind of diplomat almost, or he's been invested with these new responsibilities. And he's actually then part of the International Committee on Intellectual Cooperation, which was kind of an advisory board for the nascent League of Nations or Society of Nations. In French, it's Société des Nations. In English, it's League of Nations, right? I'm getting it mixed up now in my brain, but that doesn't matter. So he has no time for philosophy, and he finds this to be completely tragic. He's, you know, assailed with correspondence, buried under his correspondence, exhausted. He keeps complaining about it in his letters, saying he hasn't taken a day off in two decades, not even an afternoon off. So in the early 20s, he is doing all of this kind of really important, I guess, work. But he's also finding time to read Einstein and to study Einstein's theories. And so there's this episode as well where in the early 20s, Einstein and Bergson meet publicly, and Bergson tries to explain to Einstein that while he has no problems with the mathematics of relativity, there's still durée, right? You know, there's still metaphysical stuff that the physicist isn't getting to, or there's unconscious metaphysics at play in the work of scientists that they need to reckon with to be able to understand what they're doing. And Einstein isn't impressed by this and sort of has a one-liner, you know, the time of the philosopher doesn't exist. He's seen as having won the debate, when actually there wasn't really a debate happening at all, because they both kind of spoke past one another. This, I think, depressed Bergson quite a bit. He pulled the book he'd written on this subject. He kind of pulled it. He didn't want it published anymore. And it coincides with him becoming really ill around 25. So he has horrible rheumatoid arthritis that gives him fever, insomnia, a great deal of pain. And that carries on until his final years. So he dies in 1941. Before that, he manages still to produce a final book, which he spent seemingly, you know, 25 years on, The Two Sources of Morality and Religion, where he gets into really interesting, you know, sociological questions, but also theological questions. And it's released in 1932 with he kind of invented the kind of Beyoncé, you know, album drop without any preamble. People didn't know it was coming. And a lot of people were actually surprised that he was still alive when he released this book, because he had stopped appearing publicly. He had stopped giving lectures. He was, you know, in too much pain to really do anything. In the meantime, he had won a Nobel Prize in literature. But so it seems like he'd shifted from being this icon and this almost revolutionary figure that inspired lots of people to a classic, meaning someone that everyone's heard of but no one has read, kind of figure. And the war obviously breaks out. He's living in Paris. He's the collaborationist Vichy government tried to give him exemption from the anti-Semitic laws in place, but he refuses any favorable treatment. And so he has to stand in line to register as a Jew. And that's where that's how he contracts pneumonia that kills him when he's 81 years old in 1941. So that's kind of a really quick look at sort of his final two decades. But he did really quickly drop from, you know, the height that he was at to near oblivion. And so I would say there are a few possible explanations for this.
So basically when he dies, is it not received, essentially? It's just like, oh, this is war. The U.S. isn't in the war yet, but, you know, it's kind of a not received death. Or what are the obituaries like? And then I do want to talk about this sort of dropping off.
So there were some extremely moving obituaries written by the French philosophical community, but he was at that point, yeah, not seen as the force to be reckoned with that he was before. And he he was, again, there were several, you know, several comments to the effect of when he died, it came as a surprise because we thought he was already dead, kind of thing. To get to sort of how this sort of fall from grace kind of happened. So that firstly, he stopped lecturing. And I think a big part of his appeal was his lecturing style. He stopped making as many public appearances as he did. There's also the fact that he taught at the Collège de France, which is, as I said, a place where there aren't any students really. It's public lectures, but that meant that he wasn't a mentor to anyone, so he didn't have disciples to carry on his legacy. And also he didn't have a system that they could use as principles to build upon anyway. There's also what I mentioned about his sort of speeches at the beginning of World War I that many of his followers deemed very disappointing from a political standpoint. They saw it as sort of chauvinistic sort of nationalism. There's also the sense that the war was such a huge calamity for that generation that what counted as hope and aspiration and ideals before the war had completely shifted after the war. And so what was exciting about Bergson before the war no longer was exciting after the war, because not only had a generation sort of literally been lost, but also, you know, everything about that generation had changed. The Einstein debacle debate didn't help. So it's kind of, I always look at it as something that's a bit of a shame, because it feels like a missed opportunity, because Einstein was invited to Paris by the Philosophical Society in 1922, because there was sort of lingering anti-German sentiment and the Physics Society wouldn't invite him. So he ended up talking before this audience of philosophers and being asked all these really hard questions, like what is the link between relativity and Kantian philosophy? And so Einstein was kind of giving these two sentence answers, saying stuff like, everyone has a different version of Kant, so I don't know what yours is, so I can't answer your question, kind of thing. And so Bergson was dragged into the conversation because the person hosting was sort of feeling like the discussion wasn't going the way he hoped. And so Bergson launched into this really long expose about Durée, the relationship between his vision of time and relativity. And again, sort of throughout his career, Bergson always insisted that he wasn't sort of critiquing science as the scientific methods. He wasn't saying that Einstein was wrong to be apprehending time in the way he did. But he was trying to open up this idea that there could be a kind of synthesis or a collaboration between scientists and metaphysicians. And Einstein, not only his French wasn't very good, but also clearly he just wasn't interested, or he didn't take Bergson as seriously as Bergson took Einstein, which some of the listeners might be saying, well, fair enough, he was Einstein. But actually, when you look at it, Bergson took Einstein so seriously, and he was one of the few people who actually could read Einstein. And it kind of gave rise to all these satellite debates, and the consensus was that Bergson had just got it completely wrong, when I would say it's more complicated than that. But again, I'm not a physicist, so maybe some physicists would raise their eyebrows at that. But it solidified this idea that Bergson was anti-science, didn't understand science.
Which in the post-war period is absolutely linked to ideas of like German idealism, mm-hmm. you know, like this irrationality of Germanhood that's embedded in Nazism. You know, Nazism is really everything to everyone. It's either like the hyper-rational totalitarian state or like the height of German Nietzschean irrationalism. And so, but I could see how in the post-war period this becomes associated with an anti-scientific, anti-rationalist basis, you know, which is cause of the Holocaust. So yeah, I could see that.
So that episode certainly didn't help. And then I would say in the English-speaking world, Bertrand Russell did a lot of damage. He never engaged seriously with Bergson's work. A lot of, if you read how he read Bergson, there's lots of mistakes, and you know, he's clearly not reading Bergson closely. But his bestseller that came out just around the time Bergson died, A History of Western Philosophy, has a chapter on Bergson, and it reproduces an article he actually published in 1912 when he was already really angry about Bergson. But it's a sort of really huge takedown. I would say, yeah, not charitable in the slightest, and not really, you know, engaging seriously with Bergson. But that book had a great deal of influence, and, you know, is still on a lot of people's shelves. I think I have my granddad's copy here. So I think in the, you know, and then the prevalence of sort of analytic philosophy in the English speaking world certainly meant that Bergson didn't have his place anymore
in the canon in the same way. So just writing in the 2020s, what do you think there is to recover from Bergson? You know, we talked about it a little at the beginning, but why write this book? And I guess there's as a historian and philosopher of science, there's a philosophical question, and then there's probably the more contextual question. Like, what does he have to say to the time? So maybe it would be easier to start with the philosophical question. Where do you think philosophy could stand to learn from him? And then we can move on to what does the world stand to learn from him?
Well, from what I've seen in sort of contemporary philosophy of biology, for instance, is that there's, you know, people are turning back to process as a really helpful way of thinking about organisms. And they're usually using Whitehead, the British philosopher, as the head of this movement. And when I was doing my PhD studies, I was working really in the history of biology and the philosophy of biology. And I would go to these talks, and then I would hear things about the metaphysics of pregnancy, or, you know, in contemporary analytic philosophy. And I'd always be struck about how Bergsonian it was. And I know that when you're sort of in monomania PhD mode, you tend to see your subject everywhere. But there is clearly, to me, you know, if there was a way of translating his non-analytic language into turns of phrase that are acceptable to the analytics, I think that they would gain a lot from dialogue with him. And I've also met people who are working in the philosophy of memory and who are getting a lot of insight from Bergson. So I think the way, you know, people like James were really struck by his deep, deep originality, I think he was someone who tended to look at, you know, really old fundamental philosophical problems and have these interesting takes that I don't think I've seen, you know, on the analytic side or in the contemporary side. I think it would be helpful to rediscover a lot of these. And also just the way he speaks of the relationship between science and philosophy, philosophy of science not necessarily being philosophers assisting scientists who don't listen to them anyway, so it's kind of a non-dialogue, but as a true collaboration, as something where, you know, the philosopher's going to be limited in what he or she is able to say about nature, but so is the scientist. And that boils down to the different kinds of methods that are going to be used. And actually, that's to be expected, and it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just, again, it's kind of this rejection of specialization in a sense. There's a collaborative nature to both philosophy and science. He viewed philosophy as something that should be as collaborative as the empirical sciences. And he also sort of dreamed of more collaboration between scientists and philosophers. And that's something I can really get behind, and I think could benefit the world, to put it mildly.
That's a very good place to end. Unless Emily, you wanna add anything about what people should take away, please feel free.
The only thing I was going to add is that I was writing this book and sort of researching people's reactions to Bergson and the ways in which people were drawn to him because they had these negative feelings, I guess, towards the mechanization of the world and the way that mechanization was seeping into and in a kind of dehumanizing way. It kind of, I couldn't help but draw parallels between that and, you know, the ways in which we have things like algorithms that are built to categorize us into these rigid boxes that then it can be used for political and financial gain. And then the way in which AI is said to be creative when there's nothing creative about sort of rehashing and, you know, without giving any credit to pre-existing artworks or that kind of thing. And Bergson really has a lot to say about creativity and about the dangers of quantification and that kind of rigid categorization. And I think there's a similar, today there's a similar feeling of, or at least a comparable feeling of disenchantment or anxiety around these dehumanizing mechanistic forces around us. The ways that they're stripping us of, you know, the fun parts of being human, I guess. And I do think Bergson would have something to say to that as well. So maybe that's a good place to end this one.
No, that's perfect. Everyone, check out Herald of a Restless World, how Henri Bergson brought philosophy to the people. Emily Herring, thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to having you back again soon.
Thanks so much.
Kick off summer with Memorial Day savings at Lowe's. Right now, get 5 Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. Plus, get up to 40% off select major appliances and save an extra $50 on every $500 you spend on select major appliances $396 or more. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 5/28. Mulch offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details.